I suggest to have some general discussion at the end of this series of conferences about the relationships between cognitive development and working memory. And I've tried to make some summary of different presentations. It's a hard work, especially this morning. After the boat. And I think that series of conferences, there are some advances already, I think. The first one concerns the role of working memory in development and learning. I think that everybody agrees that working memory plays an important role in development as a coordinating system for complex cognition. Juan Pascual León suggested that working memory plays a role of activating and coordinating relevant schemes. Glenda presented working memory as a dynamic mapping in relational complexity theory. And Graham suggested that the episodic buffer in Allan's model could be a kind of developmental achievement by permitting the coordination of different sources of representation. I think it's a brilliant idea. And we have seen that working memory have effect through the lifespan, as Annick demonstrated. And we have also seen that impairment of working memory are observed in many developmental disorders, as Tracy demonstrated yesterday. And working memory has also been presented as a learning potential by both Tracy and Lee. And Lee showed that working memory capacity and even working memory growth contribute unique variants over and above IQ and so on in math and reading achievement. I think it's a great result. Another point of agreement, I think, is about the fact that the development of working memory is underpinned by several factors. And the list of these factors change from one household to another. But there is agreement about the fact that there is no only one factor explaining working memory capacity as processing efficiency, suggested by Case, but also processing speed. Many speakers suggested that processing speed plays an important role in working memory, but also inhibition, storage capacity, through rehearsal, and also chunking and efficiency of selection, but depending on age, according to Nelson, but also reconstructive processes during recall, as John showed yesterday or the first day, I don't remember exactly. There is probably also an increase in attentional capacity or empower, as Valerie and Juan explained. Control of attention and switching from processing to storage, according to Valerie. Use of different codes, strategies, and probably other factors. So there are also some pending questions, many pending questions. I've tried to identify some of them. The first is about complexity. Working memory is involved in complex cognitive processes, but the problem is to know what is complexity and what are the units of complexity. Some think that complexity depends on the number of schemes simultaneously required by the task, like Juan, or the number of variables required to perform each step in the cognition, as Glenda presented yesterday, or the number of chunks, or a ratio between the work to be done and the time available to do it. And the problem of complexity and in defining what is complexity is in fact the problem of the task analysis. And I think it's a very complicated problem because task analysis requires to have some complete and integrated theory of cognition, and this is highly difficult, of course. Another point of disagreement or discussion is the problem of capacity and magical numbers. So I think that everybody agrees that working memory capacity is limited and strongly constrains cognition and development, but what is this capacity remains unclear. And Juan Pascual León thinks that this highest capacity is 7, but other authors like Glenn Andrews and Nelson Cohen think that the magical number is not 7, but 4. Another problem during these days that appeared was the problem of either quantitative or qualitative changes, especially around 7 years of age. And with some of us thinking that there is a qualitative change with young children unable to use refreshing mechanism, and after 7, this mechanism being efficient, like Valerie or Graham, and others thinking that the change is more quantitative than qualitative, such as Juan Pascual León or Chris. Finally, another problem sometimes evoked during these conferences is possible difference or resemblance, I don't know, between developmental and individual differences. Andreas Dimitriou presenting this morning his idea that developmental differences and individual differences have different roots, with developmental differences depending on speed of processing and individual differences depending more in working memory capacity. And if I correctly understood, Annick suggests that the same mechanisms are in charge of developmental and individual differences with the number of units that can be effortfully activated, the selection of these units, and inhibition and suppression. So I invite you to discuss this point that you find interesting. Thank you for attention. Ah oui, il faut le micro. L'autre est là-bas. Graham, some comments?
My comment is that's a fantastic summary, and I think you've really done well to highlight these issues. So I wanted to ask a question. I'm very struck by this, the statement that was made that working memory equals learning potential.
Yeah.
You had that earlier. And I've been struggling to try and think of whether there has actually been research, and people here presumably will be able to tell me, where you divide participants up into those with high working memory span and low working memory span, and you try to teach them something. You have a learning experiment. And is it the case that those children or adults with a higher capacity do learn more or faster or not? And I can't think of, there must be experiments like that. Is that right?
Yes,
there are.
Okay, please tell me the answer.
Well, we have a couple of experiments like this. The answer is yes. The higher the working memory within age groups, the faster and the more permanent the learning is.
In my research, I do learning potential research. I think it's not the same as working memory. We find correlations depending on the tasks, whether it's verbal or visual, depending on which tasks you use for measuring learning potential. But these correlations are about 0.45. when I look at all the research I see here, I work with special children, so children with learning difficulties or with mental deficiency. And when I see all this research and I see always the IQ measure appearing, I get shivers, because I think IQ is a terrible measure. It tells you of what you have learned previously, but it tells you nothing about the learning capacity of children, because correlation, especially with children with learning difficulties, is generally about zero. IQ does not predict their learning in other classroom experiences, but learning potential, when you measure children in the sense of you teach them how to do a task, a reasoning task, then they solve the task, and then you look at the differences between children, this can predict something. And this also, like I said, has a correlation of 0.40, 0.45 with, for instance, visual spatial memory and working memory. IQ in these groups doesn't tell me much.
I think that there are a lot of, correlational studies, but suggesting that, for example, children with high working memory capacities are more able than others to retrieve, for example, answers of additions, of very simple additions, and they are more prone than others to retrieve the answer, suggesting that they have higher capacities of learning these answers than low-span individuals. I agree that it's only the results of correlational studies, but the other way around, it's difficult to imagine why children able to retrieve results of basic simple additions would have higher capacities in working memory. I think so.
I just wanted to make what I'm about to say is very congruent with Marcos, but from a cognitive developmental perspective rather than a psychometric. And this is that in cognitive development and in the dynamic learning approach, Feuerstein, for instance, who after all was a student of André Rey, and I think was a bit influenced by me also, according to him, etc. Learning potential, in fact, is related to some kind of developmental readiness to learn. And the working memory is a necessary but not sufficient condition for learning. In that sense, this is analogous to mental capacity. As you know, I believe mental capacity is the maturational component of working memory, and we have a lot of experiments proving the point with training experiments in various contexts. And again, if you appraise the mental demand of this kind of activity, well, the person will learn, will perform well, if and only if actually has enough capacity for learning and gets the learning experience. Mental capacity or working memory by itself doesn't give you a high performance unless there is a repertoire enabling the performance.
There is a question by Annick first and Andreas after.
Just to go in the same direction and give a response, having to find in my memory, you would find some empirical evidence of what Juan just said in a few of Robbie Case's studies, in which he really did do that and went far in that direction, because he was contrasting the SGSS level children, whatever, okay, but those who had a sufficient level, not sufficient, and training them, and showing that only those who had a sufficient level, just in the same line as what Juan said now, only those succeeded. So you have a very clear limit there.
That's right. Well, thank you very much, everyone who's answered my question, because I should, Andreas is going to say more.
I'm trying to remember an experiment that we completed about a year ago. In that experiment, we separated between children of different ages in processing speed and working memory. And we did have three groups, a control group, a group which received the material to work on their own in mathematical reasoning, and another group which was trained on solving the problems as such by specific strategies. The two parameters of efficiency, speed and working memory, did differentiate between those who simply received the material and those who were trained. Those high in working memory and speed, there was no difference between conditions, between the state of the two efficiency parameters. Those who were low could only profit from training as such, which means that if you are high in these parameters, you build the learning process and the learning environment yourself. If you are low, you have to be guided. I remember the experiment.
Yes. I think my general point is I think these studies, or more of them, would be an interesting way of complementing the studies of individual differences, for example.
Well, I just want to comment on Graham's. I don't have an intervention study per se with a control group, but I have done studies where I have tried to test the limits of working memory. And so you have you give a task, the working memory task, and sort of initial condition. And then I come back through a sort of a dynamic testing procedure to sort of increase the limits of working memory. And then I try to present another condition where they are presented the asymptote level, but this time without help, without the probes and so forth. And I have found in an article, it was in Developmental Psych in 1999, so it's been a little while, where I found across a various age span that the gain condition contributes unique variance. So something was gathered there overall in predicting achievement measures, math and reading. And so I think there is some part of the training that in working memory that is unique and that does contribute overall. Now, I've done that also, and this was in the Developmental Psych article, was with about 800 samples, so it was large. And it went up to an age, it went from 6 to 85 age range. And I plotted it on verbal working memory measures and visual spatial working measures. Now the difficulty is there's really no interaction there. If you're high, you get better. You're low, you get better, but you keep your same distance. And that's the difficulty. And I don't have a control situation, but I certainly have attempted to test the limits on that. And so it is kind of an intervention.
Maybe it could be interesting to have some discussion about complexity, because it's a difficult topic. And because there was a kind of position between Glenda's ideas that complexity is linked with relational, with number of dimensions to be taken at the same time for solving problems. And Juan Pascual León, who suggested that it's not the number of dimensions, but the number of schemes that can be simultaneously activated. And I think that there is a strong difference, because dimensions pertain to the domain of representations, while schemes are processes and instruments to manipulate these representations. Am I right?
Well, if I can.
Glenda first. Ladies first. No. You can.
Well, I was going to say that I think there is a. If one looks carefully at which schemes actually produce an effect in increasing the complexity or the mental demand, it is not any scheme. It's only the schemes which are actually not facilitated by the situation. And when you do that, in fact, dimensions of variation are intimately related to that. To my mind, dimensional analysis is a structural analysis which is coming in the direction of schemes which are not facilitated by the situation, are complex enough, have enough information behind it which is not manifested, so that actually manifested, that is cued by the situation, so that, that the subject actually must keep alive that scheme internally.
I'm sorry, but it seems to depend, because if I'm right, you gave the example, for example, of the balanced task. So balanced task. And, yeah, but in your analysis of the task, for example, among the seven schemes activated are two schemes related to the weight, for example. And it's difficult to imagine that the weight, the problem of balance, is not given by the situation. It's well, strongly.
Let me just point out that the situation, a scheme will not be given by the situation when it has to be extracted from a situational complex which does not make it salient. And this is the case of weights.
I'm not sure of that because Sigler, for example, demonstrated that the first level of understanding this problem is just to notice weight. And there is no children that do not notice weight in this problem, in fact, suggesting that weight is a salient characteristic of the situation. It's not to suggest that your analysis is wrong, but it's to suggest that it's very difficult to imagine that complexity of a situation can only be described by those schemes that are not strongly activated by the situation, because in most of the situation of the real life, we have just to take into account this characteristic.
Not weight in general. It's the weight in an arm or the other arm.
Yes, of course.
It's not absolute weight. And anyhow, I don't think we can settle this matter in a brief discussion. But it is certainly possible to analyze the situation and decide.
Glenda.
Okay, this is complex. The way I see it, in Graham's theory, we try to analyze complexity in terms of the task variables alone, whereas I think in Juan's theory, you bring in extra stuff, don't you? Yes, you bring in, it's more person-related. Yeah, so I think we can think of Graham's theory as a subset of your. I mean, there are differences in the way we. Yes. Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the way we do it, focusing on the task, because we feel we can get a better handle on that. Whereas when you bring in these organisms. Whatever that word is, variables. I'm not saying they're not there. I'm just saying that I think it's harder to get an objective handle on those in term to try to get a quantitative sort of...
Annick has something to say.
Okay, let me give you also an example, perhaps from all the research of ours. We used to have a system of task analysis that was very close to what was done in Graham Halford's theory in terms of dimension of transformation. And I think the difference between the two approaches can be exemplified with one of our tasks. One of the tasks, well, I mean, most of the tasks we were using for the period, let's say we needed to coordinate, I am not going into detail, three dimensions of transformation, which was the highest most difficult trial, this is the task variable, the most difficult items were requiring altogether as kind of a picture of the overall complexity of the task, a coordination of three dimensions. And some easier trials were lower. So that's on the kind of what Juan likes calling structuralist approach, which we also call structuralist. Now in one of the tasks, in most tasks actually, but in one of the tasks, was very interesting because I then manipulated this from an empirical point of view. We came to realize, it actually happens to be one of those I just showed earlier, we realized that indeed the child was overall indeed using the three dimensions. But at one point, if he wanted, he could coordinate two, get to a result, and that this result of two coordinated dimensions articulated with a third one, with a third dimension. Therefore, if you took a temporal vision of how the task was processed, the difficulty lowered. Okay, because at any one point, and this is how also Glenda Andrews mentioned it yesterday, the task analysis is aimed to assess the highest point in difficulty in the task. In that case, in two items, we thought that to start with, indeed, it does require to coordinate the three aspects, but he did not necessarily need to do it at any one point. He could do it two by two. And so then we manipulated this from an experimental point of view. We forced the children to coordinate first, manipulating or let alone the details. And indeed, the level of complexity was much clearer, and we did not have this kind of large inter-individual variance. So it depends when the three aspect or two aspect or whatever, the difficulty, the complexity, relational complexity, can the child get rid of it? Can he at one point relate only two of the elements, even if we experimenters think he has to relate three?
I think that sounds to me as though a case where the complexity analysis has to be revised, because clearly they were segmenting it. The task could be segmented and they could still get to the right answer. Yes, so clearly that would have, the complexity analysis would have to be revised. And I think this relates to the one of the principles I spoke about yesterday, is that we really do need clear process models of what is going on in these tasks and how people are actually performing the task in order to get a good measure of complexity. And that's really a key to the whole analysis of complexity. You need good independent evidences. And one way of getting that is to do these sort of microgenetic or very protocol analyses almost to find out what is actually going on there and how they're performing the task. And I mean, that is an area I think that needs a lot more work in some of these tasks. The example of transitive inference that I talked about yesterday, I think is one that has had a lot of work done on it, but there are other areas where that's not been the case. And so the best you have sometimes is your own introspections about how it's doing, but I don't think it's sufficient to rely on that. You do need to at least test that out a little bit to get a clear analysis of how people are actually performing the task. Otherwise, you will get errors in your complexity analysis.
What I find interesting is that this maximum number of dimensions that can be held simultaneously by adults is the same number of four as the size of cost of attention described by Nelson. And it seems to have something there important with the number four rather than with the number seven. I'm sorry of that. But do you have, Nelson, some idea about the difference between four or seven? Because in the old times, the magical number was seven, and the modern limit is four and maybe two in some circumstances.
So the question you were asking was about the different numbers and what they mean. And instead of getting into a discussion of the specific theories, I want to talk about the psychometric issue, because there are two ways in which I've arrived at this number four, and actually I was inspired by a chapter by Donald Broadbent in the 1970s, but one way is that you assume that if they have this number of slots in working memory, then if the stimulus has that many items or that many chunks, performance will be perfect. So you look at the level of for perfect performance. So like if the array has three or four items, adults typically do nearly perfectly. And another way is a model-based way, so that if you have an array with more than four, you assume this guessing process and you fit the model, a very simple model, but still a model to arrive at the parameter k. And so that's one psychometric type of approach, or two approaches, I guess, but they converge. And what I guess I'm wondering is, well, several things. Why would you assume, for example, in a simple list, why do people remember seven items, even though I'm assuming the capacity limit is four? And I'm assuming, and Donald Broadbent assumed also, that there are strategies that can be applied, like chunking and rehearsal and so forth, that can help increase your performance. And however, the basic capacity differs from these strategies in that the basic capacity is assumed to remain rather static, but the strategies are kind of hit or miss. You know, you do it adequately this time, not another time. And so you get partial correct on it. So in other words, if a list has seven items, you can often get it right, but you don't get it right every time. And my understanding is that I think that some of the other people that were talking about larger numbers were talking about 75% correct performance. And if that's the case, there is probably a different set of assumptions or a different rationale behind using that measure. And so just psychometrically, there isn't as much disagreement as it would seem, probably, because if you just take simple lists, you'll find, you know, perfect performance at around four and 75% correct performance around seven, you know, so fitting it to the model is the issue, you know, and there, that's where I'm more confused about, you know, what the other approaches are.
Thanks. Some comments? Juan.
Well, I think in the developmental tradition, it started with Claparède. Claparède proposed that the probability of error, error being any contingency that leads the subject to fail, could be perhaps 25%, and the true signal of success, therefore, could be a passing rate of 70%, roughly speaking. And I believe that certainly was adopted by Piaget and by all sorts of people. And I believe the rationale was this one. If you want to find what is the ability to cope with a performance in principle, and therefore you want to discount all sources of error, which of course occur in actual individuals, so as to appraise what is the ideal performance in an ideal subject, you will take a 70% passing rate. You will not take a 100% passing rate. For a 100% passing rate, if you want that, you are going to get a task which is actually less demanding than the subject ideally could cope with. I don't know where I am explaining myself. Yeah, particularly in children, Chinese is adding.
Okay, so I think your argument was against the 100% correct criterion, but I can possibly see that. But I think the most principled thing that we've done with this psychometrics is a recent paper with Jeff Rauter in my university, who's a mathematical psychologist. And we did a fit of essentially my model to the data. And in this kind of model fit, you don't assume anything. You put in parameters that represent your assumptions about these errors. And when we did it, we found that there was a need to add one parameter. And this parameter was the likelihood that the subject would zone out and just completely not pay attention to the trial, regardless of how many items were in the array. And in this study we ran, we got a remarkably good fit. So the free parameters were not very many, but there was, each individual had their K value, and they also had an A value, which was their inattentiveness. And in the study we ran, the trials just kept coming one after another relentlessly. And the A value, the inattentiveness value, was fairly large. I think it was like, I want to say maybe like 12% of the trials. But then everything fit very clearly. But then after that, we started another study with children. This other one had been adults. And the only difference in the study, the main difference in the study, was that the subject initiated each trial, and that A value dropped to nearly zero. So in other words, as long as the subject is allowed to initiate the trial, the model fit, without really having to worry about poor attentiveness. And so there's a guessing factor. You know, all you needed to assume is that a certain number of items each time went into working memory, and that if the subject didn't know, they guessed. But what I'm saying is, in some simple situations like this, you don't have to just make this general allowance for errors. It can be fit with the model. And in this simple situation, you know, it worked quite well. But in general, I can see why going with the perfect level of performance isn't the best way to measure things.
I think in the spirit of Claparède and of cognitive developmentalists, the tasks are not simple, are complex. I think when we compare the kind of tasks cognitive developmentalists use versus experimental psychologists, it is quite clear that cognitive developmentalists are addressing implicitly or explicitly problem solving, while experimentalists, by and large, are addressing perception or learning, etc. Subjects are better trained for the task in question. So that I think perhaps we are coming close then at the end. Yeah.
Well,
can I add one more thing?
Sorry.
Yeah? The issue about the number of schemes, I think the number of units, can be shown. We did an analysis of the Raven matrices and the figure intersection test, you know, the paper. The Raven was analyzed by Bureiter and Skardamalia in 1979, about the mental demand to solve these items. And we analyzed the Raven's matrices together with the figure intersections test with the Resch model. And it showed that the Raven's items, in fact, were much closer to the original model than the fit items. And our suggestion was actually that children would use strategies to solve the figural test items instead of a maximum number that you would need to integrate simultaneously in the Raven items. So strategies seem to be very important in the number of schemes that can be addressed.
So I suggest to end this advanced course by this, Heidi, and I would like to thank you for attending this conference, and we hope that you enjoyed the advanced course and that you had a pleasant stay here in Geneva. We had a great time putting all this together, and even though it has been hectic lately, you might have noticed that we had to share the workload among several persons. And because of the unexpected departure of one of our collaborators, that is why some of you receive inconsistent or, on the contrary, redundant information sometimes. We did the best we could in these circumstances, and we would like to apologize for any inconvenience. I would like to thank you, the speakers, who gave wonderful talks and very interesting, I think. And thank you, all of you.
I, before Pierre goes on, I suggest to the audience that we thank very heartily Pierre and all of his team for a so nicely organized course and a nice... Thank you.
Thank you, Annick. I should mention that we are in debt to Mr. Jean-Rémy Berthoud for the photos here and in the hall, yes. And we forgot to put his name on the pictures. And and most of the pictures you can look in our website or from him. Talking about the website, we will soon add the audio recordings of the lectures, and as well as the pictures that we took during the whole session. So please have a look to the site to do that. Our plan is to publish the lectures of this advanced course, and so we'll get back to you later if this project worked out. And I would like to finish by I think we forgot one of the main problems. Will the 19th advanced course of the Archive Jean Piaget be organized here or there? It depends if Glenn does invite you. So thank you.
But it's not totally over yet, because Pierre, we have a surprise for you. So let me just change the switch.
Thank you. I think I'm in danger. No pictures. It doesn't work.
It works.
It works. Too bad.
Okay. So, oh, sorry. So, we can get a clear recipe of how to organize an advanced course, a Jean Piaget advanced course. So, first of all, you have a person who organized this, who is here, Pierre. Then you have the title of the conference, and you put that nice, neatly on such, I don't know, we say banderole in French, I don't know how to say that in English. Then you organize this as well. You can't see that pretty, because it's too dark maybe, but it's one of these actually, because they were really nice. You have a nice and dynamic team. We will help attendees. You will need to keep track on time for the lectures. And you will, of course, invite well-known researchers and keynote lecturers. So I will really, I'm sorry, it's not that dark in my on my screen. So here, yeah, that was supposed to be Glenda. And I'm sorry. Here, as you all can see, this is Nelson Cohen, Valérie, Andreas, and Annick. Then you have an audience. You organize poster sessions. You sell books. And this leads everyone to chat and to have really nice conversations during the conference. And then you invite the staff and the speakers to get to social event, and we get all there together by tram, as you can see, with the little cutie son of Tracy. And then here it is on the boat yesterday. And so the last question is, then you have two persons who got in charge there, so Pierre and Cécile, and you have Cécile saying, oh, Pierre, it was so nice, let's surf on this wave and let's organize the next one. And you have Pierre saying, oh, no, you think so, because it's so demanding. So thank you, Pierre and Cécile, both of you, because you did a really great job, and I guess that we have something for you.
Oh, wow.
I think that this is yours. Ah, thank you.
I have a last word. Our colleague, which worked very much too, is Vincian. So thank you very much.
Yeah. The team has a very deep knowledge of the chief. Yeah. Thank you. So let's have a reception.